Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 206, All Fire and Brimstone, a horror show. The squeamish should gird their loins, prepare the poultices, polish your monocles and tighten your bootstraps, grab your smelling salts, roll up your sleeves, fetch the brandy, brace for impact. It's an episode that will begin a series of episodes which are clouded by a fine bloody mist and a fog of confusion. We're going to look at the Amaxhosa cattle killings of 1856-57 and then the Zulu's most bloody civil war clash, the Battle of Ndundukasuka. One was a millenarian movement gone hopelessly wrong. The other was an old story of a young prince seizing power from the heir apparent. Both epics are an exploration of human consciousness and both changed South African history. Cetshwayo Khampande of the AmaZulu was amassing great power under the very nose of his dad, King Impande. Hold on. Before we head off to Zululand in forthcoming episodes, we're going to peruse southern Transkei, alongside a magical river called the Clara. The little river is only 20 kilometers long, a tiny snake's tail, a meandering, whispering essence, slithering through deep ravines and splashing in splendid mini waterfalls. This is a case of dynamite in a small package because the river harbored dark secrets. It was to bear witness to a catastrophe. The twists and turns of this saga are echoed in the twists and turns of this river. It's a squiggle of a sprint for those 20 kilometers. Cliffs, thick forest, more jungle, make it impossible to walk along its bank for very far. Giant shadows are cast at dusk and dawn from the strelitzia and the reeds. A sandbar blocks its final sprint to the sea, which bursts open sometimes in summer, a blend of bush, cliffs, forest, and water. It was a day in April 1856, the exact day is lost in time, when two youngsters, Nonkwawusi, who was an orphan of 15, and Nombanda, who was about 8 or maybe 10, left their homestead on the Clara River. Nonkwawusi's uncle, Mhlakaza, had asked them to chase birds away from cultivated fields. As they shooed the birds away in the early morning of that April day, Nonkwawusi heard voices. She turned, and standing inside a nearby bush were two men. They gave her a message, which she was to relay to Mhlakaza when she and Nombanda returned. "Tell that the whole community will rise from the dead, and that all cattle now living must be slaughtered, for they have been reared by contaminated hands because there are people about who deal in witchcraft." The fusion in faiths and the beliefs and shades were intersecting in this youngster's mind. She had heard the stories about previous prophecies as she grew up, about Mlanjeni, the riverman, and Inqayele, the war doctor. The violence and upheavals of the frontier wars were paralleled by a huge spiritual upheaval, which resulted in a clash of Xhosa and Christian religious ideas. As you'll hear in a moment, Mhlakaza had a coat of many colors. He had his own grand story to tell. Back to the voices, which was not finished.
"There should be no cultivation,"
intoned the strangers via Nonkwawusi, the medium, the conduit.
"But great new grain pits must be dug, new houses must be built, and great strong cattle enclosures must be erected."
In the message, you can begin to feel the repetition of previous millenarianist-type narratives. The voices continued.
"Cut out new milk sacks, and weave many doors from buka roots. So says Chief Napakadi, the descendant of Sifuba Sibanzi. The people must leave their witchcraft, for soon they will be examined by diviners."
Heady stuff, powerful words. The fact she mentioned Sifuba Sibanzi alone was dramatic. Sifuba Sibanzi, the broad-chested one, a divine or even messianic figure. Sifuba Sibanzi would lead the people to a renewed era, a pivotal concept, a leader with the powers of salvation. This from a 15-year-old, as troubled as she was. Why didn't this moment just pass? An emo goth triggered orphan. The aunties could have muttered something like, "Shame, she's had a terrible time. It's all got too much for her." Why did this message from an adolescent turn into one of the most destructive events in Amaxhosa history? Let's see what happened. When the two girls went home and told Uncle Mhlakaza, he didn't believe them at first. Historian Jeff Perries has published a revealing work called The Dead Will Arise, which is the most authoritative research into the Xhosa cattle killing. I'm using his research and oral tradition to paint these events. The next day, Nongqawuse and Nombanda went back to the same field and were once again visited by the two strange men who appeared in the same bush and asked how their message had been received.
"They only treated it like a joke," replied Nongqawuse. "Nobody listened. They said we were telling fairy tales."
The two strange men apparently then said that Nongqawuse should go to her uncle once more and this time say to him, "We wish to see him, but that he must first kill a beast, wash his body clean, and having thus prepared himself to appear before us, come to us in 4 days' time." When Nongqawuse relayed this order, Mhlakaza had an epiphany. From the description of one of the strangers, he realized it was none other than his young brother, Nongqawuse's late father. He had died, and here he was, standing in a bush. Nongqawuse had been orphaned as a baby, but would have had some idea about what her father looked like from descriptions. Still, Mhlakaza was immediately seized by fear and began following the instructions. Then he went to the field 4 days later. Nongqawuse was standing alongside. Mhlakaza waited for the strangers, who appeared, but only Nongqawuse could see them. It's about at this point that most folks would send young Nongqawuse for a bit of sangomering or cleansing by the traditional healer. Instead, Mhlakaza took the other route, the route into what you could call madness. For Nongqawuse told Mhlakaza that the strangers had more to say. They were the people spoken of in the former days by Ngxele and Mlanjeni as being a strong people who would render the Xhosa assistance they required in driving the white man out of the land. Mlanjeni and Ngxele's ghosts, apparitions of the past, returning to provide salvation for the Xhosa reeling after land loss and the terrors of the Eighth Frontier War. A millenarian promise to be protected from settlers, an infusion of Christian belief, animist tradition, and hope. Every major cult in the world forever has demanded some sort of personal sacrifice in exchange for eternal life, or some kind of salvation. That's how this all works. Human beings are naturally drawn towards the story of hope. We are a species infatuated with magic, deterministic in our preference for smoke and mirrors rather than the blunt angles of science. The modern necromancer is the interminable digital influencer bedecked in TikTok and Instagram filters, all shiny and golden, shedding pounds in time-lapse seconds, taking semi-naked selfies in mirrors in a bathroom as a pudgy mass of fat magically disappears from their bellies. And when things go wrong, blame the witches. Or George Soros. Or those deadly pizza restaurants in New York trading baby blood. Salem witch trials, albinos murdered in Tanzania, conspiracy theorists on speed. Everything is connected through this. Thus, our two young girls living along the Clara River in 1856. But what drew Mhlakaza into his niece's obviously troubled world like a badger to a honey tree? This is where things get really interesting. Mhlakaza had another name, Wilhelm Goliath, and he'd lived in Grahamstown after his father, who was one of Xhosa Chief Sarhili's counselors, killed his mother in a fit of anger. Goliath, aka Mhlakaza, had been so shocked he'd left the traditional ways and lived in Grahamstown, learned to speak Dutch. He was baptized as a Methodist, then married in Christian rites to an Mfengu woman called Sarah. In 1849, Goliath Mhlakaza became the personal servant of Nathaniel James Merriman, the Archdeacon of Grahamstown. As Jeff Perries points out, this was a relationship that would change Mhlakaza's life and South African history. Merriman ran the Church of England in the Eastern Cape. His technique in terms of running the mission was unique because we should say he walked his mission, literally. He walked from town to town across the Cape accompanied by Goliath, who carried his bag. These two men trudged and strolled side by side for 18 months. Sometimes not exactly side by side, because Merriman's journal speaks of Mhlakaza lagging behind at moments. He was carrying the bag, after all. But the journeys they took were epic. On one ramble, they trod from Grahamstown to Graaf Reinet, on to Colesberg and the Orange River, then turned east to British Kaffraria, to a town called Alice, back to Grahamstown. That's over 1,000 kilometres. The two men, an Englishman and a Xhosa man, faced prejudices as they walked these thousands of kilometres over a year and a half. Farmers turned them away. Townsfolk frowned as they made their way from dorp to dorp. As they walked, they spoke of God. Merriman wrote later,
Wilhelm and I, as was our usual custom, sometimes under the shade of a mimosa bush, sometimes in the dry channel of some river, sat and read together both in the Xhosa and English testaments, trying to understand my language, as I his.
Mhlekazi began to preach as he went, sermons to Xhosa men and women on the route, enduring their mockery and their scorn. And thus, Wilhelm Goliath was the first Xhosa man to receive an Anglican communion. He scorned the Methodists with their public emotional outbursts, preferring the purple-frocked seriousness of the Anglican way, private confessions, a traditional religion. As a pious Xhosa man, taking ritual and tradition seriously made sense. He was now converted and knew the Bible well, the Ten Commandments, and deeply hostile to even the most innocent Xhosa practices. Merriman and Goliath's tramping ways, though, ended, and they lived in the Anglican community of Grahamstown, an expensive place to live. So Merriman retrenched Goliath, his partner of so many escapades, a journeyman, nay, a friend. It turned out later the main reason was not the money, but interpersonal relations. Treating Mhlekazi like an equal on the road was one thing, but here in the elite little settler town, it caused Merriman some embarrassment. So he found Mhlekazi a job in the nearby village of Southwell, but the War of Imlanjeni, the Eighth Frontier War, led to that school closing, and Mhlekazi returned to work for Merriman. Mhlekazi no longer wanted to be seen as a servant. He wanted equality. Both had the same God, the same services. Both were Anglicans. The major stumbling block was that Mhlekazi wished to become a full preacher and told the Merrimans
about a vision that he had in connection with the spread of the gospel, and I felt sorry I had laughed,
Mrs. Merriman wrote in her diary. Laughing at someone who is speaking of a deep philosophical mission is so caustic, so disturbing. No wonder what happened next. Blocked and ridiculed by the very household which had promised so much, Wilhelm quit the Merrimans in 1853 and went off to live near his sister's homestead on the Xhosa River. That was inside King Swahili's country, inside the Transkei. As he walked there, he cast off both the ways of the Europeans and the ways of the Anglicans. He was walking back from the gospel, back to the Xhosa ways, a cleansing walk, as all are if done in relative silence and thought. He dropped the name Wilhelm Goliath and went back to Mhlekazi. He arrived in Xhosa with an orphan of the Eighth Frontier War, who historians believe was Nonqosi. And so we jump forward to April 1856 and Nonqosi's visions. Mhlekazi's life experiences had transmogrified into a Baptist Xhosa salvation moment. As with previous prophets, word began to spread, hastened by Mhlekazi's retelling, and Xhosa in the region began to take note. Remember last episode I mentioned the terrible lung sickness had raged for months before Nonqosi's visions became sentient. The two stories merged like a psychological tsunami in the minds of the people who were losing their cattle through some unknown disease. Lung sickness was not endemic to South Africa. Like many other diseases, it had been brought by ship. The offending vessel had sailed from the Netherlands in 1853 carrying a few sick bulls. The mystery of this disease, where cows died terribly asphyxiating, shattered the Xhosa. And when they heard of Nonqosi's reasoning that everyone was bewitched, unclean, it all made sense. We've been wicked, our cattle have died. If we stop being wicked and kill all our unclean cattle, we'll get new ones and simultaneously drive the white people out of our land. That was the essence of the message. That was just the start. Not only would the cattle be killed, but all corn should be destroyed, all clothes, cooking pots, copper rings, hall hose and metal implements, everything they owned, thrown away. Then purify thyselves by seclusion for 3 days and emerge pure and clean. Word spread misinformation that new people could be seen on the grasslands, new people wearing the old skins of traditional Xhosa, driving purebred Xhosa cattle. They were content with abundance. Nonqosi went further, tapping the New Testament. The millenarian urge was upon her. If the Xhosa cleansed themselves, then all the people who had no arms and legs would grow these back. The blind would begin to see again, and old people become young. The dead would arise.
Shaken by reports of these visions and the Xhosa response, King Sarili sent his brothers Ndima and Xoxo on a fact-finding mission to meet with these so-called new people lurking around Qara. Sarili's uncle Buru sent his sons as well, Qwabe and Xosini. When they arrived at Qara, Mhlakaza said the mythical new people were out on an expedition against the colony. They could not be seen, but the sons of the king seemed convinced they existed and that Nongxhosi was telling the truth. When Qwabe arrived at home 2 days later, he slaughtered some of his cattle while Xosini went further, sending an order ahead that the cattle should be sacrificed for all his wives who had small children. Sarili was being drawn inexorably into the cult-like activity, sending 4 cattle to Mhlakaza as a gift, then dispatching his counselors Kinku and Klapklaba to British Kaferia. They had a message for all chiefs under British control. You must begin the sacrificial process. A quickening was taking place, like people hyperventilating. In the coastal areas which had been extremely badly affected by lung disease, Xhosa began exterminating their herds. A minor chief called Tabai headed off to Qara to see these new people himself and returned declaring he in fact had seen them. His image was greatly enhanced by that dubious claim. A few other visitors were less certain. They went on the pilgrimage to Qara and upon returning home hesitated. The big problem with cults and millenarian movements is that those who don't join in get blamed if the big reveal, the ultimate salvation, etc., etc., fails. Some killed a few cattle to show faith, to avoid being tagged as unbelievers, then waited. That was until King Sarili showed up at Mhlakaza's homestead in Qara in July 1856. He had been on the throne for 20 years. A tall, gangling man, 47 years old, a Tlaleka man who'd survived 3 British invasions and preserved most of his land across the Kai River. He'd fought off the Amantembu, who'd allied themselves to the British, and now he was wealthy, thousands of head of cattle. Like many others in our history, he had the gift of the gab, and his knowledge of traditional practices was legendary. He'd centralized a fragmentary Xhosa kingdom. It was this leader who rocked up in midwinter at Mhlakaza's little home. Sarili was going to be the last truly independent king of the Xhosa in the Transkei for quite some time. Beneath the surface of this leader, beneath the lanky, knowledgeable exterior, was some darkness. He'd been brought up with the shades, those dark forces skulking around, managed by magicians and diviners. He'd hardly known his father, Hinsa, who'd been shot by the British. His mother and his father basically separated, despite Hinsa being king. He had a broken home. Then the British shot his father, the first Xhosa chief to be treated like this. Oral tradition points to the moment things improved for him. It involved a python. A trader with the name of King shot one of these huge snakes in the Manyubi forest, about 180 kilometers north of where East London is today, at the glorious Mazeppa Bay. Unbelievably, pythons were relatively unknown, and the skin and bones were transported to Sarili's great place, Hohita, and ground down to powder, concoctions produced. These were used on the hunter-trader king, his hunting party, and the chief. And then a short while later, the Amantembu were defeated. And thus his power was coiled up with that of this python, and traditional storytellers have a few verses reinforcing this connection. Sarili is the great python which encircles Hohita. He who awakes too late would have missed it, for he will have not seen the python uncoil itself. While Sarili's power was unquestionable, succession was another matter. The chief had 5 wives, but all of his sons died. All sorts of dark arts were blamed. And then in the midst of personal crisis, the missionaries arrived. They brought stories of resurrection with them, of Christ walking on water, of the image of the crucifixion. And as Sarili travelled to meet with the prophet of the southern Transkei, Nongxhosi, he was aware that lung sickness had broken out at homesteads near his own great place. The darkness was closing in. So when Sarili arrived at Qara to hear for himself what these 2 girls were saying, it was a shock when Nongxhosi and Mhlakaza pointed to the ocean and said that the ancestors were going to walk out of that water, resurrected. Somehow Sarili saw his great son Nongxhano, who had died at the age of 12 in 1853, in these watery reflections, emerging to live again. He issued formal commands, Imiyolelu, to the Xhosa nation to obey Mhlakaza's instructions. Then, as if to reinforce his determination that these theories were true, he had his own favorite ox slaughtered. This was an animal known throughout Xhosa land.
During the next 13 months of this cattle killing, between April 1856 and May 1857, about 85% of all Xhosa adult men killed their cattle and destroyed their corn in obedience to Nonkosi's prophecies. It is estimated that 400,000 cattle were slaughtered. 40,000 Xhosa died of starvation. At least another 40,000 had to leave their homes to search for food. But it had another effect. After a dogged 80 years of resistance to colonial expansion, the Amaxhosa struggle collapsed by their own actions, and almost all their remaining lands were given away to white settlers or black clients of the Cape government. Next episode, we'll piece together what happened in Xhosa land through the end of 1856 and begin dealing with the other major incident of the period, the AmaZulu Civil War Battle of Ndunda Kasuka. It also features a river, the Mighty Tugela. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platforms. It helps elevate visibility. And you can head off to desmondlatham.blog. I'm going to load an update about a few episodes. You can email me from there. Until next, Salagatli.